Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another WriteStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, joining you here on April 16th, 2013. Hard to believe how quickly the month is flying by. And as usual, I have two wonderful guests lined up for you this afternoon, and I'm very excited to speak with both of them today. But before I get to that, I would just like to send out our prayers and well wishes and thoughts to everyone affected by the terrorist attack in Boston yesterday. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just take a moment of silence to remember the victims, the first responders, and all of the heroes involved in helping in the wake of that horrific attack. So God bless them up there. We'll keep sending our prayers their way, and hopefully we will get to the bottom of whoever did this. So, excuse me, before we get started with today's, my first interview with wonderful author Boon Yam, who has one of the most compelling stories I think I've ever read, I would just like to take a moment for a programming note to let you know that the WriteStream Radio Network started last month, actually. I believe March 4th was our first broadcast of 2013 with the program Just Believe with host Lisa Tarvez. And that program runs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you haven't checked it out yet, you should, because Lisa she's such an uplifting, bright spirit. She's a metaphysician and intuitive, and she always brings on the most motivating, interesting guests to her show. And so whether we're talking about miracles, as she did this everyday miracles, as she did this past week, or about love and learning how to love yourself, or holistic healing, ways to deal with diabetes naturally and to help yourself heal from things like that, you won't want to miss one of Lisa's broadcasts. And if you can't make it live, you can check out all of our shows all on WriteStream by just simply going to blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream, and that'll bring up all of the archived broadcasts. But Lisa Tarvez, Just Believe, airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And then we have the wonderful author, military historian, and journalist, John D. Gresham, who is the host of Military Monday here on the RightStream Radio Network. And, of course, he broadcasts his show every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Yesterday, his guest was the wonderful Fred Rainbow. And every week, John brings on fascinating guests to discuss various aspects of the United States military and issues affecting them, as well as issues of national security, terrorism, war, things that we really should pay a little bit more attention to and understand. And I really appreciate John's ability to delve into some of these topics with guests who are very personable and interesting and informative and very accomplished. So check out Military Mondays on the RightStream Radio Network with John D. Gresham at 1 p.m. Eastern. Okay, and without further ado, I want to get to my first guest, who is, as I mentioned, one of the most inspiring people I think I've ever met, and certainly his book is one of those books that just really gave me a renewed appreciation for the blessings of liberty and for the life that I've been blessed to have here in the United States of America, you know, as a born and raised American citizen. And that's something I think that we as Americans take for granted. And I think it's, you know, something that many of us are fighting to preserve during these dark days. But certainly Boone has lived through some of the worst oppression that we've seen happen on the planet. And his book is called Tomorrow I'm Dead, and it is an autobiographical account of his journey from 14-year-old slave of the killing fields in Cambodia to his eventual escape at the age of 17 and his ultimate triumph as a leader in the Cambodian Freedom Army, and how he went on to rescue thousands of his fellow citizens, his fellow countrymen. It's just such a great story. And I first met Boone about 2 years ago, and he and I had an interview back then on a different radio program. But I'm very excited to bring him back to the show, to the new and improved RightStream show right now. So without further ado, I welcome author Boone Yam to the program. Hi, Boone.
Good morning, Dara. Long time no see.
I know. How have you been?
I've been still alive.
So, Boone, I gave you a brief introduction there, but, you know, we have a new audience that's listening, so why don't I go ahead and give you a couple of minutes to kind of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, my name is Boone Yam. I'm born in Cambodia, from Cambodia. Right now, I'm in United States, USA. I'd like to tell you, last year, I became a citizen already.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, I'm a USA now.
Awesome.
Now, right now I'm living in Washington State. Yeah. I've been promote my story. It keep going up right now. It's not a millionaire yet.
But you're working on it though, right?
Yeah, I'm working on it right now. Some new things happen soon later. I'd like to tell you, I got good news come out. Like my CD's already come out.
Recording
a CD. Tomorrow I'm Dead.
So it's an audio version of your book that people can listen to.
Yes, people cannot read and they cannot listen. They can put in the house, in the car, driving, wake him up. And another one. The English translate to the Spanish books already come out too.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's terrific. And, you know, I think that audience, you know, the Spanish-speaking audience will be able to relate to your book because, you know, there's been so much oppression, similar type of oppression in places like Cuba and in Latin America. So I think that's fantastic that you've made the book available in Spanish as well.
Yeah, probably this year my book translate be Cambodia and Thailand and France.
Wow, that's
yeah.
That's
they
terrific.
Keep going up. The people they like my story. They say this story is supposed to translate all different national because the war is terrible right now.
Yeah, well, Boone, you know what? Since we have a new audience here, why don't I just want to ask you? I want to kind of getting back to, you know, the original publication of the book. Now, it came out 2 years ago, correct, in 2011?
Yes.
Okay. And it's fabulous. I mean, I remember I've read it and reviewed it, and it's basically your real life account of what you went through as a slave in the killing field. So take us through that, because I just want to give people, without giving away the whole story, obviously, but I want to kind of take people through so that the audience will want to go out and buy your book and truly understand what that was like. I mean, you were taken from your home. They literally came to your house when you were 14 years old and kind of took you away. Explain a little bit how that happened.
Okay. That year, April 1975, and after the Cambodian New Year, and then United States take troops back home, and Khmer Rouge, they take over the Cambodia. And that day, my family, everybody have fun and freedom, everything. Next morning come up, and Khmer Rouge, they tell all the people out from a city, they forced go to in the jungle. After we go to the jungle, like 2 days later, we have no food. The Khmer Rouge, they say, get out the house for now and come back later, like 2 days later, come back. No need to get anything with us. Just one pair of clothes and walk away from home. So my family, my mom, my dad, and my brother, my sister, they walk together. And 3 days later, we have no food, no nothing, and never return back home. The Khmer Rouge, they say, we need some kids. Go get some food, because we have no food for 2-3 days already. And my mom sent me, my old brother, my sister, and Khmer Rouge, they take me away from my brother. My young brother, he's only 6 months old, stay with my mom, my dad. And then I walk away from them. My sister and me, my old brother, walk away from my parents. We don't see it. And next day come up, and Khmer Rouge say, okay, we need girls, go to girl, boy, go to boy. So they separate my sister from me. And only me, my old brother together, I tell my sister, when you get food, you bring to mom first, because mom have no food for 3 days already. And then if I find food first, I bring food to your mom first. From that day, we separate. We don't see face together all the way. A day later, me and my brother walk together, and the Khmer Rouge say, sit down right there, wait. You got new project. And then they ask kids one by one, take a test for. Like, the kids have mom and dad be rich people, lawyer, doctor, teacher, the past back 1975. And then they take the kid and go away, put it one place. And they ask one kid. Kid say, the farmer, they put different way. So the kid, they have a parent business, education, all of that. They put in the truck and then go to all the kids kill. And they keep only people working, farmers, go to work, slave working on the next day.
So if you were from a family, Boone, let me just repeat this, because I really want the audience to understand this. You know, so for the Khmer Rouge, if you were from a family of achievers, let's say, or, you know, business people, or, you know, lawyers, doctors, educated people, you were immediately killed. And if you claim that you were from a farming family, they spared your life. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct.
But you became a slave.
And the farmer kid, they turned to slave working.
Okay, because that's what they were after, was basically slave labor. And they,
yeah.
Okay.
Like me, that day, I'm in a farmer. I tell them the truth. They take a test me. I say, I'm a farmer. So they send me a go to farmer kid. And then next day, they stand on a line.
Gosh.
And they tell me, take all the clothes out. We have a color clothes that day. They take all the color clothes. They take a watch. They take ring, necklace, everything. They pile it, one pile, put up. Right back, and then they give out one pair of clothes, white color, one pair of clothes, no T-shirt, no underwear, no nothing, just one pair of clothes. And then next group, they give me equipment, go to work. And then they say, you know what, we go to work because we have no food for a couple of days already. And the work, when we take a look over there, go to far away, and then we saw the river, big river, and they say, dig the dirt, bury water. And then they say they want to make the dam go another side. So we start working 3-4 months later, and then we have no food, not enough food to eat, and we keep skinner, and my hair starts to fall out, and skin and bone. And then they feed us only one scoop of soup, right? Just barely salted, right, on the soup, and then the salt.
Oh, my gosh.
That 23 hours a day, we walk around the clock, keep dig the dirt, bury water, build a dam that day. So all my friends keep weak and cannot walk, and he fell down, he died. He's not died yet, he's still not stand up, and then a Camaro turn our crew, drag him out, put in a truck. He's still moving. And then some of my crew broke in equipment. And then Camaro run through to him, what happened? He said, my equipment broke. And then he just take stick and hit him behind, and he knock out. And then we drag my crew, go to dump the truck again. And the truck keep full, and then it dump in the hole. It's still alive, all my friends.
So you witnessed them. Your friends were still alive, and they were thrown into this pit, basically, and left to die.
Yep, left to die. And then they don't let us talk about old time. Like, yeah, I have a big house, new car, new truck. They don't let us. If you hear all that, and then they say, go to meeting. Go to meeting. We know to go to dead, go to kill them.
Oh, wow.
Now, that year, I remember everything. Day by day, just keep praying for the God come down, help, get out from a criminal.
Horrific.
Not enough food, not enough sleep, and work, skin and bone, no hair. I don't know my family everywhere, nothing, because we've been separate that year.
Unbelievable. Now, Boone, and you said you worked 23 hours straight? They
23 hours
work?
Straight, around a clock. And then 1 hour sleep. 1 hour sleep without one piece of clothes and rain, hot, cold, my clothes already rot. That's all they give us, one pair, 1 year.
Oh, my gosh. And separated from your family. So at this point, you don't know if your family's alive or dead. You don't know where they are.
I figured out myself. I say, is I terrible like this? All my family, my brother, my sister, the same thing. Maybe he already dead, cannot survive.
Yeah. Now, and I want people to understand this. So now, you were the Khmer Rouge was holding you at gunpoint, basically, as well. I mean, I'm trying to really get people to understand what this was truly like for you and all of the others who were held captive. So, in other words, if you fell down because of exhaustion on your one cup of rice, was it one cup of rice a day that you were allowed, and that was it? So if you were, and they worked you to death, literally, in many cases, if you were to fall down, you were considered no longer useful and just sort of discarded like trash.
Right. When you fall down, you're done for that day. Never come back.
Wow.
They just drag you to throw in a pit. Every second, every minute, every hour, the people keep fell down, have no energy, no strength, no nothing to stand. To keep working, continue, keep going.
And Boone, how did you, I mean, it's a miracle, really, that you were able to survive these horrific circumstances. I mean, not only your own suffering, but watching the suffering of your friends, watching them, watching the communists basically throw them away when they were no longer able to stand up or even, stay alive themselves. How did you, where did you find the inner strength to keep going? I mean, the physical strength, the emotional, mental, spiritual strength. How were you able to keep yourself going?
Yeah, that night my friend said, Boone, how we find some right eat or anything to eat? I said, keep eye on the ground. Everything moving, everything somewhere. And then we get to eat it because we eat only one soup of scoop rice, not enough for all energy, dig the dirt, bury water like that. And one day we found a snake, a big python. And then we asked Khmer to go to pee. We don't have nothing to pee, it's only water. And then we go in the jungle for 5 minutes looking for food. So and my friend, they found a big python. And he run back to me, boom, we found a snake. what we're going to do? I say, that's a good food for us, and anything, we can kill a snake. So I talk my friend and go get a stick, and then we kill a snake, and then we go eat one. You get two people, take a break, we go eat snake. I go eat snake really hot, really fast that day, my whole crew. And then only two kids, they eat the too fast, and then blood come on a white pan, white clothes. And the commander say, where you blood come
uh-oh.
From?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and he say, he's hungry, eat snake, where the snake? And then he take two kids with him, and then it's not come back. Next day, come back. At night, I tell my friend, we got more energy already, eat the raw snake, and we need some eat some more tomorrow. Tomorrow, when I run down there, the snake is gone, and then my two friends been throat cut and live right there.
Oh, God. So they
come back and tell my crew, I say, my friend is already dead, and then no snake, they already gone. So we pray together, we say, how can we get some more food? I say, well, so I tell my friend, everything, we eat rat, we eat snake, we eat a crapper, we eat everything we can cut, we eat more. That day, that's why we survive day by day.
Right. Wow. Well, I mean, that is pure evil. They slit the throats of your friends and took the snake away. And I guess that was supposed to be a lesson to you. You know, this is what will happen to you if you continue to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. And then after we have project, dig the dirt, bury waters, all done, and then we have a right season come up. The right season come up, and then they say, well, we got to change. Kameru tell us we have a new job to do. So we take all. Climb on a truck. I barely climb on a truck. Talk myself. I tell my friend, you know, when I'm in school, I can jump very high. I'm learning taekwondo. Right now, I cannot jump. All my crew, too, carry me, throw me on a flatbed in the truck. My butt hit the truck, hurt my bone. Oh.
Oh.
Yeah, we got no meat. We got bone and skin, that's all. And then we have no hair. Everybody's skinny. And they throw out like 4 hours later, they drop out and oh, we dead right here. Oh, my friend, 200, they say, oh, we dead right there. The next, and Kameru say, okay, you know what, you come here? We say, we don't know. And then they say, you stay here. All your crew stay here. Take equipment right there. Power right there. I talk with my friend, say, we done on that day. We cannot go forward. They kill us right here. They turn up, put equipment, pile it. And then one commando come up and say, we're going to sleep right here. Tomorrow we go to work the next day. The next morning come up, they cook food for us to eat already. I say, you see over there? So, wow, that's a rice field. Whoa, that's a good job. It's better than dig water, dig the dirt, bury water. It's a good job. It's not heavy. And the commando, they say, well, after you eat, we line it up, and then before we plant the rice, I said, what plant the rice? I never planted the rice before. I look like rice tree because I'm a farmer. And they say line it up, before we plant the rice, we got to clean up junk in the field first. We have a deep water, look like almost a foot of water in the field, like 100 feet by 100 feet. And then we line Kameru and say, okay, line it up and step, go forward and clean all the junk, log, everything, get it up before we plant the rice. And we start walk, and my crew hit something, his leg, say, what is this? And a Kameru run through, say, what you doing? Say, down here. So he said, pick him up. So we pick him up. We saw the dead body on the ground, in the water. It's big. And the commando point the gun, say, pick him up and put in the truck. And then I tell my friend, go, you pick him up. And friend say, no, Boone, you pick him up. And I say, well, commando yell some more. You don't pick him up, we kill you right now. And we go pick him up together. Like four people pick one up. I try to pull one hand, and one hand come out. And then come out, and then fell on in a water, flopped to anybody. And
his
friend tried to pull
off?
A leg. they come out too.
Oh, gosh.
That's
horrific.
That day we carry all the dead body, put in truck. Yes, we found that one day we have like 600 body in the field right there.
600?
Yeah, after we complete everything, like 1,500 dead body all together. That's a couple days later. And that day when we have no place to sleep, we sleep together and all body wet in the water. And we drink water right there. We have nothing to drink. We cannot go nowhere, come out to point the gun all the time. Cannot move around. Just keep working, clean the field. That my friend died a lot that day right there because he cannot stand and smell stink. Dead people in the water, blue, brown. I'm thirsty. I just drink water right there, too. I put my shirt on the water and suck it that day. My friend got learned like me, and then we had no good water to drink, no clean water to drink. It's not enough.
You know, Boone, listening to this, it just makes me realize even more how lucky, you know, that Americans are, and it's unfortunate that so many of us take it for granted. You know, we think we have a bad day when we're inconvenienced, you know, by having to stand in line at the supermarket or something. And listening to you, you know, offer this real-life account of such horror, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's just as bad as anything you could ever see in a horror movie, except unfortunately this is even worse because it really happened. Now, how long did you have to survive like that? And just without giving away too much of the story, though, eventually you were able to escape. So give us a little sneak peek about that. How were you able to finally get away from them?
I've been trapped in a killing field like 2.5 years, 2.5 years, yeah. And that night we fell asleep, and then we saw the rock fly to my bed, the rock. Fly.
A rock, okay.
Somebody
like
throw the rock to my place. And then I tell my friend, I wake him up and say, somebody throw a rock to me. You go take a look what it is. And then my friend said, no, Boone, you go take a look. I said, no. He said, maybe the Khmer Rouge. I said, Khmer Rouge is not play game like this. They don't like you. They just take you to a meeting. You done deal.
Right.
And then you never come back. And some friends say, Boone, let's go. I say, we don't afraid of ghosts because we've been sleep in a dead body and ghosts every night. Drink water right there too. We don't afraid them. And don't say nothing. Next morning we go to work like normal work, and then next night come back, rock fly back again. Back again and say, wow, that's the same time rock come in. I tell my friend, wake up. And then he saw the rock come back again and said, there's something wrong out there. I want to go see. He said, Boone, don't go. There's a Khmer Rouge out there. I said, well, I got to go. And when I go down there, he said, Boone, be careful. I said, if I go, I come back, I'm still alive. If I don't come back, I know that you know that the Khmer Rouge take me away. And then he said, okay, I keep eye on the Khmer Rouge. Because the Khmer Rouge, they sleep about with the roof, everything, the good food, everything.
Oh, of course, yeah. They were living high off the hog, huh?
Yeah, they on the high, on the hill a little bit. And then
At
night, 10 o'clock, I say, they cannot see me. I cannot ask permission and go to the bathroom. I just slide on the ground, go see who throw me. They throw rock to me, I throw back. And they throw back to me, I see the flashlight. That's why I want to go see who out there.
Oh, wow, okay.
I wasn't scared to die at all that day. I say, my parents already dead. My brother, my sister already dead. I'm the last. I tell myself like that. Pray to God, and God help. If I go see the good people or bad people. When my last day, that day, I tell myself. But I go down there, come closer, I say, who are you? And then he say, quiet, come closer. I say, are you Khmer Rouge? He say, no, we Cambodia freedom. I say, he say, come closer. When I come close to them, I lay my back on the dirt and my face on the sky. I see, whoa, that's a different clothes. They flash light on his uniform. I say, it's not a Khmer Rouge. So I come close to him, I say, who are you? He say, Cambodia Freedom. Come help people. I say, how many people you got? He got only two. And he asked me, how many people you have, your crew? I say, 200. And then they say, okay, tell your crew, next day we need to get out from this. When I saw like that, I just get out from them. I'm look like fly. I go in and slow. I go tell my friend. He still sit down and wait for me. I say, there's good people out there that come help us. And then he don't trust me. I say, tomorrow we go see. So next day he go see with me. He saw the Cambodia Freedom lay on the ground flat, and he jumped over me and said, don't make a lot of Khmer Rouge hurt. We kill them together. And then the Khmer Rouge say, okay, tomorrow at 10 o'clock we need to get out of this place. And go tell all your friends one by one. And next morning we tell our friends already to get out 10 o'clock. And Cambodia Freedom Army, they say, when we get out, you keep eye on the sky. The baby chicken star go across, go hit the Thailand. I thought, wow, Thailand, I never heard Thailand before. In the jungle, where the Thailand look like. So 10 o'clock, 8 hours, how many Khmer Rouge house out there? We tell them we have 15 house. And then we build a house for them that day. And then we know how many. And then the Cambodia Freedom Army, he said, we need 15 kids. I said, okay, we have 15 kids. I say, why? He said, I need 15, and he give match for 15, one each. Match is one each. And then keep eye on the 10 o'clock and let the 15 start fire the house. And then another more 100 go this way. So one army and 15 kids and one army, that 100, more than 100 go with them. So at 10 o'clock at night on time, we have a watch. The Cambodia Freedom give me a watch and flashlight. How to use technique to use so nobody can see.
Uh-huh.
And 10 o'clock, it start cut on fire. And Khmer Rouge say, fire, fire, fire. Anybody get fire big. And then one army, take all my crew, run. Get out 10 o'clock at night. 45 minutes later, almost 1 hour, the bomb everywhere. Bomb on the far way, bomb behind, bomb on the side, bomb everywhere.
Oh, my gosh.
One bomb hit on my crew. My crew screaming, yelling, oh, help, help, help. I'm hurt. And some my friend behind me said, boom, boom, let's go back. I said, no, let's not go back. You go back, you die anywhere. And
right.
We need to go forward. Doesn't matter. The Cambodian freedom out there. Let's go to Thailand. But that day, we got only 5 people follow me. I can hold my back, hold my shoulder because I swing my arm. I hit the tree. I got to get away from tree because we cannot use flashlight. We cannot use anything because we're scared. And they got more power to get out from that place because one scoop of soup rice is not enough power. That day, that night, we got more power than double. Get away from them. And next morning come up, and then we're looking for friends. One over there, two over there, three over there. We take a clothes, white clothes out, and then they cannot see us clear, and then we keep looking one by one, one group. That day we found that's not all, but a Cambodia Freedom is say, okay, let's go find some eat. And Cambodia Freedom give all 5 people go get some food.
Give you new clothes.
And then they cook for all my friends shake. I shaking, my friend all shaking, mm-hmm. Hungry with the good food.
Boone,
and
wait,
one friend.
How many of you made it? Let me just jump in here. How many of you made it to freedom?
I made
night.
The freedom 170.
170. Okay, so there were 170 of you that managed to get out of there and
yeah, 170. I come with me like 70 something, and then plus another army. They split to another side. So that day we go to camp. We go to camp, and then we found together. We got 170 left. So we know that 30 already dead out there. And we're training from Army.
Now, let me ask you, can I just interject too? How long did it take you from the time you escaped into freedom? Now, so they were, I just want to, for the audience, just want to clarify. So they were in Thailand, the Cambodian Freedom Army, and they used rocks. They were throwing rocks at you at night to get your attention, to let you know that they were there. and you guys managed to get across in spite of the bombing. You snuck across the border, and you made it into the safety of their jurisdiction. But, Goon, how long did it take you and your friends, because you were all obviously malnourished and beaten down and physically abused, how long did it take you to fully recover your strength? I mean, I know they gave you food. You know, how long until you were back to feeling healthy again?
That day, 3 days from a criminal to the safe place of 3 days.
Yeah, but how long did it take you to
and,
healthy?
And after that, take me like 3 months.
3 months, okay.
Good food, good sleep, and my hair grow back, and my skin come back red. And
excellent.
Then 6 months later, I go down and help people.
Now, Boone, did they have, I just kind of want to try to picture what it looked like. So they had, the Cambodian Freedom Army had sort of a compound set up there in Thailand where, you know, they provided you housing and a place to sleep and shower and just kind of recuperate, recover.
The Cambodian Freedom Army, they got their crew. They have in the border of Cambodia, Thailand, they make a camp. They got a rope. They make a road. They buy product from Thailand, blanket, all kinds of stuff, pot and pan to cook.
Okay.
Everything.
Excellent.
Look like normal people.
Yeah, and I remember reading in your book, and this is really a testament to your spirit and just your ability to endure and your desire to help other people, rescue other people, was that, you know, I remember reading how you were so anxious to get back in there and rescue, you know, your other countrymen who were still suffering under this slavery, and they kind of had to convince you to first heal yourself and get better and get your strength back before you jumped in and did that. So you're saying it took you fully 3 months to really recover and get back to normal.
Yeah. Okay. 3 months, go back to normal, and then if you got good food, you got good sleep, it's not take long, you come back. Because you get angry with the Khmer Rouge do to you like that, you get more power when you good sleep, good eat.
Mm-hmm.
And after 6 months later, we training with army training, and then we go down there, go bring people out. Yeah, bring people in the jungle, starving, old man, old lady, young kid, everywhere in the jungle, it's not in the city. They stay group by group, and then I go down there with a bare hand. The first time, I bring 1,000 people out from that night.
1,000? That's incredible.
1,000 have no food, people sick, all kind of people, skinny, really skinny.
Can I ask you too? I'm sorry. Another question that popped into my mind about how many miles was it? You know, how far did you have to take these people to get them to safety? Was it, you know, 20 miles? Was it how far to the border, to get them out of there?
From a Cambodia go to a Thailand border, depend on what side it is. My side looked like 20 miles, 30 miles.
Okay, wow, so good distance.
And my long distance walking.
And did you do this at night, undercover? How were you able to evade, you know, the communists? I mean, how were you able to get away from them? You sneak them out without them seeing it. Was this all under cover of night, or?
Yeah, I go at night. Go tell them at night. You cannot go at day because the Khmer Rouge control the people.
Right.
They don't let the people go find food at all. At night, people sneak out, go find some food for the family, but we go at night. When I go at night, I change my uniform. I put the army uniform away. I put the white cloth in there. So that people don't scare, say, well, where you come from? So we have white collar, the same them, and then they say, okay, that's our neighbor. But that day when I go down there, I saw old man, old lady, and a kid, they cry, hungry, no food. I call them mom and dad. How you doing? Say, well, my kid hungry. We have no food for 2-3 days already. We're looking for food. We don't have it. And then I tell her, you need to move to my place because I got more. My parents have food, everything, good food. And then he say, yeah, Boone, I saw your skin better than my skin. I say, yeah, Khmer Rouge fit up better than you city right there. And then I try to talk with them, let them trust me, and then we take the whole city out. And I did. I just take mom and dad, get out, go see how food we get from. And then he saw that And his wife said, wow, that kid, he's not lying. He said, good food. So, and
yeah.
I told old man, old lady, say, you go back, tell all the people, we need to get out from this city. I asked them how many. He said, more than 1,000 people, kid and adult. I said, wow. And then we prepare for food, how many people, and then we call all crew out there, bring some more food on halfway. So that night, I give them food a little bit, and then mom and dad pray everywhere. I say, wow, we never have food for 2-3 years. Right now we got good food, and then we do something with the Camaro. So I tell, we need to take all the people out safe, because they keep stay like that, they keep hungry, keep starving, and then people keep die. So we take all out that night. Walk, go in the jungle at night. Some lady is scared, never walk that deep in the jungle. And some kid sick, we cannot walk, we carry them out, feed them medicine, everything. And then we go to camp. The people in the camp help people in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Help together, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
Very terrible.
Wow. Well, it certainly is a true story of heroism and people helping other people and rescuing other people. It's incredible. Now, Boone, how long did it take you to reunite with your family?
After the first time, I just want to tell a little bit of story for that. The first time I go to bring Cambodia out, I have no gun, no nothing. The first step, and second time, third time, fourth time, they get worse. And then a lot of people, the Khmeru, they know Cambodia freedom, take people out, and then the Khmeru kill more people that day. They just saw they kill, and then army, we know that Khmeru do like that. We bring more army out in the jungle right away. And that day when we have like 3,000 or at least 3,000 people on my back in my army, like 30 army protect them. And then I tell them we need to go this way. Before we go, we know there's a lot of mine everywhere. I say I need 5 feet, so I go first. I'm looking for mine first. I see a lot of mine on the road. I just take them out. I miss one mine and step on myself that day.
Oh, God.
Oh, shake. They want to pop up. I step down. I tell my friend. I tell people behind. Just knock 30 feet around. Just stay back there. And then my army, my crew, dig a hole for me. deep enough.
Right next to me.
Right next to me. And then he wrapped my face, my nose, everything with the rag, everything. So they don't infect my air, my lung, everything. After he already done, and he said he back up like 30 feet, and then he give me a signal, and then I just jump in the hole, and then the mic off 5 feet, and they trim out a tree like 30 feet around everywhere. So my body burned with the air. They suck my clothes, everything, blood
oh,
everywhere.
God.
And my crew strike me out. Like almost 1 hour later, I wake up, they wrap my body tight. I said, what happened? I asked my crew, what happened? My crew said, you step on the mine. All the people behind, they just pray for me. Don't die. You help a lot of people. And that day when I go out, tell my boss, say, well, you need to take a break. You're still alive. You help a lot of people. That for 1975, to 1980, yeah, 80,
mm-hmm.
We helped 10,000 people.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, in a sale play, and 1980 to 84, because 1929, Vietnam bring troops, help people that night, that day, on a Cambodian New Year too, but if Vietnam come in, Khmeru get out from a city, go in the jungle. So Khmeru's go in the jungle, and they keep killing more people. People run away everywhere. So we, on a Cambodian army, different way, we bring people out. So Vietnam, they saw my army, they shoot us. They shoot the Khmeru both ways. So we run around, find all the people in the jungle. look like play monk, play something. And 1984, my mom just found me. 1993, my mom found me. So, wow, my mom found me, so I don't want to die anymore. Before I put my sign, tomorrow I'm dead. They got more detail on my story, too, why tomorrow I'm dead. And then my mom found my brother in United States first. Back 1925, he escaped. And a couple years later, my mom found my sister. My sister in France. He go France.
Okay.
And 2-3 years later, my mom found me in Cambodia. I'm still joint army special force to help people in the jungle. And I tell my boss, I want to go see my mom. I separate my mom back 1975 until 84. I don't see them.
Oh,
my
wow.
boss said, no, I go bring your mom here. I said, no, in the, this is a dangerous zone. I don't want my mom here. He been run away from 1979. My mom had a story, too, that year. Very bad. Try to escape from Khmer Rouge, go to Vietnam side. Walk away from my crew because of war. It's almost end. Only army and army fight together. There's no reason to put my life on the line because of people already say them all not in the jungle anymore. And 1996, my mom found my old brother in Cambodia right now. So my brother, my sister, all still alive.
Everyone survived.
Did everybody make it?
81 survived. Yeah, make it. Come
Your
to
whole
United.
Family survived. Oh, that's wonderful. And you came to the United States after
yes.
that? Okay.
After that, my young brother come to the United States in 1975. They sponsor my mom. And my mom sponsor me. My mom sponsor my sister.
Terrific. And Boone, you settled in Seattle?
I'm in Tacoma right now.
Yeah, but I mean that but the Washington State, that's where you decided to move to when you came to the United States, correct?
Oh, the first I come to United States in Ellensburg, Washington.
Okay.
Ellensburg.
Okay. And when did you now after all this happened and you were safely out and you know you're in the United States? When did you get the idea that you wanted to write about your experience?
I'm live in Lundsberg, my city. They know that they asked me where are you from. I said Cambodia. Oh, Cambodia, they got a killing field, Cambodia. I said yeah, and they want to know more the killing field because they watch a killing field movie. It's not enough. They saw me. They said, that's real. I said, I'm inside a killing field. I'm 14 years old that year. It's all enough to know everything. Well, they said, well, you need to try your story. I said, not yet. That day I have a business, open my own restaurant, and the people come eat my restaurant. They say, Boone, I saw you sit down, do nothing. Just try your story. I said, well, just a little bit more. No, just keep doing. That day I decide to do it. Before I'm writing Cambodia later, one page, it keep me on, to come up by themselves. And so, whoa, wait, I want to ask my father. That day my father and my mom live in Tacoma. It's far away from me. I go ask them where they come from, how I'm born in Cambodia, what for a living to take care of me. And he tell all my story, and I go back my city. I keep writing some more. It's done, the whole book. And we go find people help me translate to be English. So Melina, she finished college. So she come to my restaurant to eat eat food. They say, well, good food. I say, well, I got a Cambodia story. I looking for people translate be English. They say, yeah, I can help you. So we can help. See how all done and all done already, and we on a radio, a Lundsberg radio, and the guy Key Johnson, he say he an author too. He come promote his book on a radio, and he say on a radio guy, Jeff, he said, well, I got my friend Boone Cambore. He writes story. He's already done, but we need to print it. So the guy helped me to print it. And then the book come out. For 2 months to come out. And go from there. Until now, try to tell people everything, how to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Believe God. Pray for God's help. Do the good thing. And I've been speak at the college, speak at high school, book club.
That's excellent.
And this morning I was radio and TV and
right.
NBC.
Affiliate.
New York.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Right before her, tell her.
Right before.
I hear Carla. I can hear her. Well, that's fantastic, Boone. And, you know, I think it's so wonderful that you're speaking to high school and college students, because there is nothing like getting, you know, an actual historic account of something that happened from a person who lived through it. That does so much more than just a plain old history book.
Yeah, at the Army, too. The Army base. The Army, they learn from me how to fight. They're teaching all young soldiers how to fight, save them life.
Terrific. Terrific. Now, Boone, do you do a lot of local appearances as well to promote your book?
I got a caller right now help me promote my book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the reaction?
They can go to Google looking for Tomorrow I'm Dead. They got CD. They got a Spanish book. They got a English.
Right. Okay. So it's great. It's available in Spanish and English. And, Boone, is it also on Amazon? Can people find it on Amazon.com?
Yeah, correct. You can go to Amazon.
Okay. And your website is booneyom.com, correct? That's booneyowm.com?
Y-O-M.
Y-O-M.com.
Yeah. M as in Mary. Yep. Okay. And I want everybody to check that out. And we got just a couple more minutes, Boone. Like what? And you kind of touched on this already, but in the last remaining minutes, what are the biggest lessons you want your readers to take out of your experience in your book? If you had to choose like 3 or 4 lessons that came out of your experience that you really want people to understand as a result of reading your book, what would they be?
I think all the world right now is just very terrible right now. And Cameron will go down and people hard to find a job.
Yeah.
And later the war come up soon. I don't know when, but try to survive. And try to teaching them how to read my story, how to survive everything. And pray to the God, help.
Pray to God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The best way, pray to God, number one, let him help.
Yeah.
And that's Try to help neighbor, try to help people, all the high school kids, tell all the kids, do the good thing, don't do bad thing.
Right. And Boone, you know what? I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. I saw this on your website that you have a Cambodian fund. Can you, in a couple of minutes, tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yes. I have 2 years ago, I do by myself. My book come out. 2004, the original book. So that day I have the restaurant. I own a restaurant. I got plenty of money already myself, but I have money for the book. I send to help people one city. The whole city I help, like 400 people that one city. Poor people, they have no medicine, no food, no water, no drinking water. So I send money to them. Help them build water, build a well, dig the well, and build a house for them.
Wow.
To eat.
So
all kind of money I send to them.
And is this still ongoing? So can people go to your website, and if they want to donate to that cause,
yeah,
they can still do that?
Yeah, it's still going. I do by myself. I don't have a corporation, I don't have nothing. I just go straight by myself to help people. The money 100% go to people.
God bless you. That's wonderful. Well, Boone, I want to thank you for joining me for this interview. You are such an inspiration, and I'm going to make sure that I share this archive and get it out there on all my social media platforms. and encourage everybody to listen, because your story is so compelling. And, you know, people are looking for heroes and leaders. Well, you're certainly a hero and a leader. And just thank you so much for being the person you are and for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. One day you got to stop by, see me.
I definitely will come out there and see you.
And
I love
Carla,
that area.
And meet Bill and meet a lot of authors out there.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, we'll have to have a big party. And
yeah, one day we make a big party.
That's right. At your restaurant. How's that?
far away. You
oh, too far away? Okay. Well, maybe we could take a road trip, Boone. I don't know. We'll see. But thank you again. And I just want to tell our listeners again, the author's name is Boone Yam, and the book is called Tomorrow I'm Dead. Check out his website, booneyam.com, and you can also find the book on amazon.com. Please get it, read it, share it with everybody you know. Not only will you find, you know, inspiration from Boone's story, I think you'll also realize that you have a lot of blessings to be thankful for. So, Boone, thank you so much, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yeah, thank you all the people, audience out there, and thank you, God. God bless America.
Oh, thank you. And God bless you. And God bless you, Carla. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
See you next time. Bye.
Okay, bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was the incredible Boone Yam. I cannot get enough of his story. What a wonderful man and an inspiration. And again, please get his book. It's called Tomorrow I'm Dead. You can find it on Amazon.com and at his website, booneyam.com. That's B as in boy, U-N as in Nancy, Y-O-M as in Mary.com. Read his story. And also, when you're on his website, check out Boone's Cambodian Fund. As he said on the air, he runs that himself, and 100% of the donations go towards helping people in need over in Cambodia. So please check that out. My next guest coming up on RightStream is the Reverend Cheryl Kincaid. And to anyone who's always loved the Charles Dickens classic, A Christmas Carol, and I think that describes most people, I think you're going to be very fascinated by what my second guest has to say about it. Although I know most of us think of it as a tale of, you know, learning from the past and trying to be better people and helping other people and reaching out and you know, kind of staying in touch with our humanity. It goes a lot deeper than that. My next author is Reverend Cheryl Kincaid, and she's going to tell us why there's a gospel message in Charles Dickens' classic book. And without giving too much away, I'm just going to leave it at that, because she'll be joining me here in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to take a little break, and I'll see you back here in a couple of minutes with author Reverend Cheryl Kincaid.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's L-I-S-A-T-A-R-V-E-S. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Imagine a world where bullying isn't considered a normal part of childhood.
A world where I'm not afraid to go to school.
To speak out.
To be myself.
A world where I'm not afraid to be caught alone.
Come on, punk.
We have the power to stop the bullying.
Speak out.
Speak up.
Educate.
Find out what to look for and how you can make a difference at bullying.org.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message. A walk to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter, because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot, and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And, of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat.
Hi, this is Pastor Cheryl. You guys told me to call at
Welcome to the program, Cheryl. I'm so sorry. This is Daria. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Good, good. You know what? I'm so sorry. I had muted my microphone while the commercials were playing, and silly me, I can't produce and talk at the same time, I think, some days.
I understand that.
But you know what? I am so delighted to have you on the show today. Dickens, A Christmas Carol, you know, like for many people, has always been one of my favorites and sort of a hallmark of the Christmas season, but I never quite saw it in the light that you presented in with your book. So, but before we get to that, Pastor Cheryl, can you please just tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll get into some discussion on your excellent book.
Oh, excellent. My name's Cheryl Kincaid. I am a minister of Word and Sacrament with the Presbyterian Church. I came to it rather late in life. Like a lot of women, I struggled with my role as a woman and my role in clergy. But the Lord brought me around, and I was ordained in 2003. And I've been writing my whole life. Literature has been a great source of solace for me. I grew up kind of in a violent alcoholic home and found my peace not only in the scriptures but also in the great classics. And so I've been an avid reader ever since I was a kid. And I'm a pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Clifton. We're a church of about 100 to 200 in membership.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you know, and Pastor Cheryl, it's so funny that you said that, because I've interviewed so many guests on my show who have said that literature and reading the classics, and others have also said that studying the Bible really helped them to cope with, you know, different problems in their childhood, whether it be what you described or just, you know, maybe they had trouble in school. But it's amazing to me how literature has the ability to really uplift and really carry us through some really tough times. Now, was Charles Dickens one of your favorite authors growing up?
Well, yeah, I didn't really get into Charles Dickens until in my teenage years. But one of the things that drew me into Charles Dickens was I was reading a book in the library one day, and they had a little bio of him, and his father was in debtor's prison. Now, I didn't understand debtor's prison as to what it was, but at that time, my dad was in prison, and I thought, and I felt very much alone in that. So I started to read his books, essentially, because I thought, how could this guy accomplish so much and come from my environment? And, of course, I was quickly drawn into his whole conflict of wealth and poverty and the church's role in it, how in some characters you have characters in these books that are saintly and some characters who behave horribly, and what's the difference between true Christianity and fraudulent Christianity. And it's a theme he plays with a lot in his books, and I think primarily he does that because it's something he witnessed in his life, and which caused him to write many of his books. Oliver Twist, certainly Little Dorrit, the theme is very strong in Little Dorrit, and the theme is also and David Copperfield, which he called his favorite son, and most certainly A Christmas Carol.
Right. Now, you say, and it's true, I'm looking at your website now, most people don't realize that A Christmas Carol has a biblical foundation, and you talk about how each of the spirits that appear in that book directly correlate with an Advent lesson. Can you explain that a little bit to the audience?
Sure. Let me explain why he did it that way first, if that's okay with you.
Sure. Please.
What he did is, in his young life, he after he published a few books, he took a trip to America, and he thought America would be a beautiful place because he loved the democracy, the idea of democracy, and hated the classism of England. And he writes in his diary, it wasn't the republic of his imagination, in that he was so discouraged. He used to do something called sermon sampling. He'd go to different churches. And he was very impressed with the churches in New York and their take on social justice, that they were working for public education and working for the abolishment of child labor. But he was dumbfounded at the openly pious slave owners in the South. And it broke his heart. And once he talks about walking in Times Squares, and he thinks he sees all these rags on the ground, and when they turn on a light, it's a bunch of Afro-American women, and they run. They were sleeping on the ground. And the way Christians quoted scripture all the time really troubled him. So he comes back to the United States, and that's when he writes A Christmas Carol. So and he uses the Church of England's Book of Prayer, which was also the Episcopalians' Book of Prayer, which would be what a lot of the American churches were at that time. I'd say right now we're probably more Baptist and non-denominational than anything. But at that time in America, Episcopalian was the main faith. So he chooses the name Ebenezer on purpose. And Ebenezer is a scriptural term that means the Lord has brought me thus far. And you find it throughout Scripture that that's what the term means. And an Ebenezer was something that the Hebrew people would set up a stone. It's taken from 1 Samuel 7:12. And when Abraham, when God did something for Abraham, he put up a stone to remember that that's where God had brought him. And so he's trying to bring the church somewhere. And what he wants to bring it is to repentance. He wants to bring it to a sense that, and it's assumed with the name Ebenezer that Scrooge is a Christian. And I don't think that we get that nowadays, but it certainly was assumed in the text. And the Victorian Christian would have recognized it. But the first candle is the candle of faith, of hope. It's the prophet candle. And in that candle, we meet Scrooge. And I just want to read you a quote from Scrooge, because Scrooge is a lost soul, and they say, oh, he was a tight-fisted, hand at the grindstone Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetousness old sinner. And I love this quote. He lived in chambers which once belonged to his deceased partner, and they were a gloomy suite of rooms, a lowering pile of building up in a yard where they had no business being, and one could scarcely help but fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing hide and go seek with the other houses, and forgotten to find its way out again. So you got an idea that he's lost, and he got lost as a child. And Scrooge is making the point that he was abandoned at one time. And the first, and because this is the prophet's candle, the first first spirit to see him is a spirit from the prophets, exactly from the book of Jeremiah. And you don't mind if I just keep talking, do you want to?
Please, no, please do, okay. Pastor. I'm fascinated by this. Okay. I'm listening. But I just, let me just remind our audience real quick before you continue on, though. If anybody does have a question or wants to call in, the number is 347-945-7246. Okay, go ahead.
Well, he comes in, and they cut this. A couple cartoons have included this, and I think the version with Patrick Stewart includes this part, but the Disney one didn't. I wish they had. But he comes home, and he's sitting by this fireplace, and it says it's a very low fire indeed, nothing on such a bitter night, and he was obliged to sit close to it and brood over it before he could exact the least sensation of warmth from such a handful of fuel. The fireplace was an old one, built by some Dutch merchants long ago, paved around with quaint Dutch tiles designed to illustrate the scriptures. And there were Cain's and Abel's and Pharaoh's daughters, Queen of Sheba's, messenger angels descending through the air on like feather on cloud feather beds. And there were Abraham's and Belshazzar's and apostles being put off in sea boats, and hundreds of figures to attract his thought. And yet it was the face of Marley, 7 years dead, that came to him like the ancient prophet's rod and swallowed up the whole. So the prophets had the rod to rebuke. Jeremiah said he used his rod to tear down and to build up. So he uses that language specifically to say that that's the prophecy. And, you know, the Book of England's prayer book is has a lot to do about the poor, as did the Episcopal prayer book. And I think Dickens was enraged people weren't listening to that. And so the words of the prophet that that Marley speaks, and this is another quote, I think it was taken, it was Disney didn't include it in its version, and I don't think Patrick Stewart did, but it's the most important quote of the book. It's when Marley says, "Why did I walk through the crowds of my fellow beings with my eyes turned down and never rise them to the blessed star, which led the wise men to that poor abode? Mm. Were there not poor homes to which its lights would have conducted me?" And then he sees the phantoms, and all these phantoms can't ascend into heaven or go to hell because they're chained by money. They're chained by their own greed. And he goes outside, and he sees this woman, and this woman is sitting there trying to nurse a baby in a doorway, and all these ghosts are seeking to intercede, but they can't do it anymore. They've lost the ability to help. And so they've made for themselves a type of hell where they're chained to their own greed. And that the quote goes directly to the image, and I know you've probably seen the movie and cartoons, and they may have included the image without the quote, but the quote's very important because Christmas, the Christ Mass, is to lift our eyes up to heaven. You know, the early church, before I go on with the stages, celebrated three masses. You know the story. There was winter solstice where they celebrated where they beseeched the sun to come back. Mm-hmm. And the church could not participate in that because the ceremonies were more than party life. They were pretty much orgies and kind of demeaning ceremonies. There were temple prostitutes involved. So the church hung out in graveyards, and they had three masses. And I want to just read you a statement that by one of the early fathers called Origen. He says, "For this reason, for which the church doesn't number her days by the measure of her seasons so much by the motions of the sun," meaning winter solstice, we got to have the sun come back or our crops will fail and we'll starve, "but by the course of her Savior, who being the true Son of Righteousness is now begin to rise on the earth." And so they were worshiping the Son of God instead of the Son of the universe. And they had three masses. And the first mass was God being born eternally in the heart of the Father. That was known as the Incarnation Mass. The second mass was God being born in the belly of a woman, that God uses people, which people contemplate on, to bring his purpose about. And that's called the Virgin Mass. And the third mass was the most sacred mass of them all. And this was Christ being born in the heart of the believer, which was known as the Christ Mass. And so clearly, although Ebenezer is a confessing Christian, Christ has not been born in his heart today. And so they had a statement, Christ in the past, Christ in the present, Christ in the future. So Christ in the past was being born in the heart of the Father. Christ in the present was being born in the belly of a woman. Christ in the future was being born in Christians' hearts. And so that's why there's three ghosts that come to Dickens.
Wow.
To Ebenezer. So, and that's one thing I think that's lost on a lot of people. But, you know, that's why it's important to know where we came from, to know where we're going.
Absolutely. Well, I think in a lot of the modern versions and retellings of it, they try to, this is just my feeling, they kind of try to strip away the Christianity or at least water it down, you know, I don't know, or they think they're making it more palatable for an audience, which when you look at the ratings for the Bible, I think they're doing themselves a disservice because so many people tuned into that, but, you know, things like that. So I think that's part of the problem is that, you know, in our culture today, there's this feeling like that in order to be successful in making a film, you've got to kind of, you know, you've got to water down those elements. And I'm so happy to have you on the show today to really explain that because I didn't realize about the three masses and the whole foundation of that. Very interesting.
And most of the letters I get from the book, they're thankful that I give the evolution of the Christmas. And I show that they weren't just trying to stamp Jesus on winter solstice. They were trying to protest winter solstice and trying to say, this is what life is really about.
Yeah.
So do you want me to go to the second lesson?
Absolutely.
Let's continue on. The first one is the prophet's candle, and we just learned about that. And Marley comes to him as a prophet. And the second lesson is the lesson of faith, and it's the star and the wise men candle. And if you remember the cartoons that you've seen or the movie, that the second candle, when it comes to him, there's a white light out of his head, like a beaming light. And the light is certainly the star of Bethlehem. And this is also called the shepherd's candle, the wise men candle. But I just want to read you the statement where you see this angel, and you see the angel, you see the spirit, but you see the spirit more like a star. "The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, not by a hand, not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, staring up, half encumbered attitude, found himself face to face with an unearthly visitor who drew them. And the strangest thing about it was that from the crown sprung a bright, clear jet of light. Perhaps Scrooge could not have told anybody why, if anybody would have asked him. But He had a special desire to see the Spirit place a cap on that light and begged it to be covered. What, cried the Spirit, would you soon put out with worldly hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you're one of those whose passions made this cap and made me through whole trains of years to wear it low upon my brow? Scrooge reverently disclaimed any intention to offend or any knowledge of willfully bonneting the Spirit in his lifetime, and he made bold to inquire what was his business. And your welfare, said the ghost. And Scrooge expressed himself much obliged, but could not help that a night of unbroken rest would have been more convenient to that end. And the Spirit must have heard what he was thinking, because he said, your redemption then. Take heed, Scrooge. And in sometimes in movies, they change that word redemption to reclamation. Again, I think not to offend. But reclamation still means redemption. In fact, it means to reclaim someone. So God's going to reclaim Scrooge. And he's going to do it by taking him back to a place where his faith was damaged, and that's where he was abandoned as a child. And so we have, and when you go to the faith lessons in the scriptures, in the Anglican prayer book, you have the lessons of where the vineyard was trampled. That's when there was a vineyard, and this is where you get, my eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He trampled out the vineyard. God comes to his vineyard, and he notices the grapes have thorns on them. So what he does is he takes away the gates and lets the foxes come and trample the grapes. That'll break up the ground, and he'll grow a new vine. In the Civil War, the belief system was that we had disobeyed God, and God was going to bring his judgment. And his judgment was going to be, he was going to take away the protection of his people, and there would be payment of white men's blood for every black person, 10 white men's blood for every black person's blood that was spilled. And, of course, that never happened. Slavery was so entrenched in our society that still isn't true. But that's the lesson in the Book of Prayer, is that it's a lesson of what abuse does throughout the ages. And so we learn something of Scrooge's abuse. We learn something that his father abandoned him. And I'm just going to read you a little bit about his abandonment as a child. It says the Jocund, which means the traveling group, came, and he's in the schoolyard, and Scrooge knew the name of everyone. Why, he rejoiced beyond all bounds to see him. Why did his eye glisten and his heart leap up with joy as they went past? And why was he filled with gladness when he heard each give other a Merry Christmas as they parted on the roads and byways for their homes? But there was no Merry Christmas for Scrooge. Out upon Christmas, what good was it to him? And the ghost says the school was not quite deserted. A solitary child neglected by his friends is still left. Scrooge knew it, and he bowed his head, and he sobbed bitterly for the loss. And you get the sense that he was lost. It was a common practice in Victorian England that if a mother died giving birth to a child, that child was punished by being sent away to a school and being put out of the hearts and minds of the family.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Horrible.
It is horrible. And that was a dig at that practice. And then we come out, and the rest of the scriptures in the faith is about idolatry, setting up gold and neglecting the poor for gold. And when Scrooge breaks off his engagement to his fiance, she confronts him with this idolatry. She says, "It matters little," she said softly, "to you, very little. Another idol has replaced me, and if he can cheer and comfort you in time, as I would have to do, I would have no recourse to grieve. What idol has replaced you?" And he says, "A golden one." And that correlates directly to the scriptures in Isaiah, where the children of Israel worshipped golden idols. So then we go to the third lesson.
Interesting. Okay.
And anytime you want to jump in, just jump in.
Okay. No, this is so fascinating to me. I truly am getting such a deeper understanding
of his book. So, you know, please continue. Go ahead, Pastor.
Okay, so, you know, Scrooge, Charles Dickens was very much into the neglect of children, and he was writing Great Britain to say that if you neglected your children, this would be the next generation, and he believed that God would visit judgment, especially upon the church. That's why he gears some of his text toward the church, because he believes that they're under greater obligation to repent. So child labor was one of his big causes. And so we meet Tiny Tim, who has a crushed foot. And I want to tell you that one out of every four workers in the factories in Great Britain at that time were young boys. And one of the things they did for young boys, they had these large looms, and they were mechanically ran, and they were pushed down. And if a piece of cloth would get caught between the looms, it was easier to pay a little boy a couple little extra dollars to run in between the looms and grab the cloth than to set the whole operation down. And the result was that there were a lot of young boys that were amputees. Mm. But those were the lucky ones who were amputated. If you couldn't be amputated, if you couldn't get your leg amputated, you would die of gangrene. There wasn't clean water in the slums. One of the hard things when I researched this book, I understood that Dickens wasn't even advocating for the abolishment of child labor. He was advocating for an 8-hour workday and advocating for clean water. That's why in Oliver Twist, there's a lot made of the murk on the ground where Fagin loses his jewels. It falls between the murk. And Dickens doesn't say what the murk is, but everyone knew what it was. It was fecal matter and sewage that was in the streets.
Yes.
So when we see Tiny Tim, I know we're used to seeing Tiny Tim as this glowing-faced little boy with a paralyzed leg. Well, if that were true, my leg is paralyzed. I was in a car accident. That was one of the things that caused me to write the books. But if that were true, seeing a doctor wouldn't help him. And in the book, he asks the spirit, will the child live? And he says, unless things remain unchanged. What would help Tiny Tim was to have the wound cleaned and dressed. So instead of imagining Tiny Tim as this glowing-faced little kid with a paralyzed leg, imagine him with a bloodied bandage and growing and coming home with his dad with this bleeding bandage, which a lot of little boys did. And I'm just going to read you with that in your mind, I'm just going to read you the passage. It says, in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter exclusive of the fringe hanging down around him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look season-like, and Tiny Tim was upon his shoulder. Alas, for Tiny Tim, he bore a little crutch, and his limbs had to be supported by an iron frame, which is what they did to kids who they couldn't dress the room. Is they could buy very cheap iron frames and put it around it. And how did Tiny Tim behave? Said Mrs. Cratchit. As good as gold, said Bob, and much better. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much, and he thinks the strangest thing you ever heard. He told me coming home that he hoped that people saw him in church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see. And what struck me about this text was that Tiny Tim's not asking to be healed. That's a 21st century perspective to God, and if God doesn't heal me, I'll be mad and angry. Tiny Tim has an ancient Christianity, and it's the Christianity that says, will God use me where I'm at?
Mm-hmm.
And in so many ways, he asks, will the child die? And he says, what then, said the ghost, if he had, he better do it and decease the surplus population. And I need to tell you, that was a paper that was presented to Parliament, that it was called the Work Nexus, that said that death among the poor would be a good thing. And that direct quote was taken from Parliament, and Dickens understood it, and he wanted to reply to it. And he says, man, if man you be, not adamant, forbear that wicked cant or that wicked saying till you discover what surplus is or where it is. Will you decide what men shall live and which men shall die? better in the sight of heaven that you are more worthless and less fit than millions like this poor man's child. Oh, God, to hear the insect on a leaf pronouncing too much life on his hungry brothers. And there is a scripture in Ezekiel that talks about what happens when the bigger sheep butt the little ones, that God will come and butt you because you're responsible. And then I love, this is one of my favorite quotes, and it's one of those quotes I guess they could not put in the movies because it's describing something. Instead, they show it. But this is why books are better than movies, because the description is more important than seeing it. So I want to go ahead and just read the description of what the ghost does to teach Scrooge what surplus is and where it is. Much they saw and far they went, in many homes they visited, but always to a happy end. They stood by sick beds, and they were cheerful, on foreign lands, and they were close to home, by struggling men, and they were patients by their greater hope, by poverty, and it was rich, in almshouse, in hospital, and jail, in misery's every little refuge where vain man in his little brief authority had not made fast the door. And barred the spirit out, and he left his blessings and taught Scrooge his precepts. The spirit teaches his precepts, but just by his presence. And remember, what he wants to do is he wants the church to get out of the walls of the church and into the world.
Yeah.
And into the poverty. And I just have a scripture here I want to read. Brothers, about surplus. This is taken from 1 Corinthians 26 through 28. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called, that many of you were wise, not many of you were influential, not many of noble birth, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, the weak things of the world to shame the strong. And he chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that were not to nullify the things that are. And the reality is that Jesus doesn't come to us in a palace, and he doesn't come to us of noble birth. He comes to us probably lower than Tiny Tim in that he doesn't even have a house. And so Tiny Tim is the child's, is the ghost of faith and action, and also it's a lesson of the shepherds. And in that, he uses St. Nicholas, or a form of St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas, I know we've given him a round fat belly that shakes and laughs like a bowl full of jelly, but St. Nicholas was a 3rd century Turkish saint who worked for the rights of women not to be sold in marriage at a young age, which I think the real man is far more...
That's important.
far more important and significant than the fairy tale. But at any rate, so we go to the 4th lesson, which is the proclamation lesson, the lesson of the angel. And this is the, so we have, first one we have the star who comes to us as a star. The second one we have St. Nicholas who comes to us to show us the children of this world. And the third one, the proclamation, it's not a happy proclamation. The angel isn't one. They have the picture of death. And this is part of the Christmas story. It's in Matthew 3:13. It says, his winnowing fork is in his hand to clear the threshing floor and to gather up the wheat into the barns and to burn the chaff in unquenchable fire. It's also in Luke 3:17. So we have some guy with a winnowing fork, which we have noticed is death, but it's a sign of judgment. And Scrooge comes to a form of repentance. And I think it happens again at the sight of Tiny Tim, and hearing Bob weep over his child, and he says, "And I know, my dear," said Bob, "that if we were to recollect how patient he was, although he was a little child, we should not quarrel easily among ourselves or forget Tiny Tim." And then he says, "Tiny Tim, thy childish essence is from God." But when he sees his death, it's people rejoicing that he's dead. And he says, "O cold, cold, rigid death, set up thine altar here and dress it with such terrors as thou hast at thy command, for it is thy dominion. But of the loved, reverend, honored head, thou canst not turn one hair to thy dread purposes or make thy features odious." In other words, one who lives their life decently is not going to be horrible even with decay. And then he says, It is not that the hand is heavy that it will not fall when it's released. It is not that the heart is still and won't pulse, but that the hand was not open and generous and true, and the heart was not brave and tender. Strike, shadow, strike. Good deeds should spring into eternal life. And so he realizes that his life means nothing here on this earth. And he says, and this is a powerful statement of repentance, man's courses will foreshadow certain ends, to if they're not preserved in, they must lead, Scrooge says. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it's true. Spirit, he cried, clutching his robe. I'm not the man that I was, and I will not be the man that I have been but for this intercourse. Why show me this if there is no hope? And then he says, I will honor Christmas in my heart. And again, it's the Christ Mass, Christ being born in his heart, and try to keep it all year long. I will live in the past, the present, the future. The spirit of all threes will teach, and I will not shut their lessons out. Oh, tell me that I may sponge this word away. And then in the last chapter, we see him going to church. It says he went to church, he walked in the streets, he watched people hurrying to and fro, and he questioned beggars and looked on kittens and windows, and he found that everything gave him happiness. So we have a sense that he's a better man than he used to be, and which is the last lesson of the Christ Mass in the Prayer Book of Order. This is the lesson of joy and repentance, and it's the lesson of the Christ Mass, Christ being born in your heart today. And it says that, and Scrooge says, and he says he had no further dialogues with spirit but lived on total abstinence. In other words, he didn't get drunk. And it was always said of him, he knew how to keep the Christ Mass well. If any person alive possessed the knowledge, may that be all said of us. And as Tiny Tim said, God bless us, everyone. So there's the idea that from the very beginning to the end of the book, he's trying to say that Christmas can't be just a celebration. It has to draw you out of your life into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and as I'm listening to you, I'm realizing how much of that is really lost in the modern interpretation of his book. It's incredible. Go ahead.
And I think it's tragic because Dickens did criticize the church, but that didn't make him – we live in a very bifurcated society. Either you are always defending the church and always preaching it, or you're totally against it. You're the atheist. But – Victorian England wasn't that way. First of all, almost everyone claimed to be Christian, but Christians felt free to criticize the church in that society. And Dickens felt he had good reason to. He had seen it a lot in his life. He appreciated the efforts of Christians, but he wanted to show them how they totally messed up. And especially with the workhouses. They were... Originally, they were started as a Christian ministry so the poor would not starve to death in the Elizabethan culture. And in the Elizabethan culture, there were people who were migrant workers. They reaped and they sowed during harvest time, and they were unemployed during the winter, so they set up these houses and provided them employment. And they quickly, in the Victorian age, turned into places where you punish the poor for being poor. And it was out of the anger of that and the rage of that that Dickens was preaching as loud as he could to the church. And one of the things he says is they put the new master of the New Testament outside the doors, and he remains knocking.
Right.
So his statement is clear that, you know, Jesus said, what you do to the least of them, you've done to me. And the church has a special relationship, or should be, have a special relationship with the poor for that reason.
How was Dickens, what was the reaction to his work at the time in that society? Did they get it? Did they reject it? What was the attitude?
It's one of those sad things in that he didn't have the reaction he wanted until he died. They were reforming the Poor Man's Law. The Poor Man's Law was a law that essentially said you make it hard for poor people and maybe they might die and release the population. So, you know, the words of the Scrooge's words are important in that book, and the reformed law didn't pass. The reformed law failed Parliament, And it became a moneymaker for him, and he was the one that he was required to read the most, but he saw himself as entertaining the saints, and he resented it. People weren't getting the lesson. They were just enjoying the text. And of course, there's much to enjoy. He talks real pretty, you know. So, and I'm sure when he read it, it was beautiful to read. But it was after his die that Tiny Tim, after he died, that Tiny Tim became the emblem of the factory child, and became a major image in stopping child labor, and also in breaking down the orphanages, and the poor man's house. Sadly, the workhouses would not be shut down till the 40s, which is a great tragedy. But they started to change. They started to be reformed about 1920. So it'd be after he would die, the Salvation Army would use the images of Dickens, of Tiny Tim and A Christmas Carol in their campaigns as well. So they were used in a constructive way. But a lot of it didn't happen until he died. So he was disillusioned. At one time he did feel like he was just a... he was just entertainment, and he wanted to be so much more. But to say that Charles Dickens didn't have an effect on how we treat the poor most certainly would be a lie. He, you know, it just took a while for it to sink in, what he was doing.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully he's, you know, he's seeing that in a different form right now, and at least understanding that he did influence things for the better.
Yes, that would be my prayer as well.
Yeah. Now, gosh, I have my next question, and it went right out of my head, Dr. Cheryl. Forgive me. I just
That's
thought.
Okay.
But I'm just amazed. I guess speaking to the book itself and how I kind of want to shift gears a little bit in the last part of the show here and talk about, I guess, one, when you got the idea, I mean, to write your book, and tell me a little bit about that process, you know, the writing process, how it came about, you know, the publishing of it. Those sorts of things.
Well, I did a lot of recovery work when I got out of my home because it was an alcoholic home and it was filled with church on Sunday, but also coming home to drunken rages and ridiculousness that comes with alcohol. And there were a lot of broken Christmas trees, I got to tell you. And so when I had my first house, I liked the Christmas season, but I couldn't bring myself to buy a Christmas tree because of bad memories. So I started to do the Advent wreath and started to celebrate it, checked a book out of Anglican prayer book because I didn't have anything else. And I noticed the works of Dickens went with it at that time. And I used to have friends over and we'd have dinner and I'd read Dickens by the Advent wreath just as kind of a fun way to entertain my friends. But in 1993, I was in a car accident and it left my left leg paralyzed. And I'd worked so hard to get out of poverty. And by poverty, I was subsistence living. I'd worked really hard to get my own apartment in a nice neighborhood with no roaches and rats. But suddenly I was back on welfare again. It felt like, because it took me 2 years to recover. And I couldn't teach preschool. And my sister took me to a version of the Christmas Carol. And we didn't have a key to the elevator, so I had to go down the stairs with my walker, and because I was young, I drew a lot of attention. I was feeling a lot of shame, whether that was true or not, that people were giving it to me. But when Tiny Tim came on and they said, "How did he do?" and she said, "As good as gold," I just started to weep. Up to that point, that line had been seemed like a corny line, a nicety, a romantic line. And that's when the line meant something more to me, because I got the idea that Tiny Tim wasn't being like we were taught to be, that you just got to believe God for a miracle, and if you get a miracle, then you're doing right. If you don't, something's wrong. Tiny Tim had the Christianity that said, this is where I'm at. Where can God use me here? And that that broke my heart. I mean, it honestly broke my heart. And so I spent, during my recovery, I did a study of hymns, and at that time I did a study of carols and realized that carols were about telling peasants gathering to rich people's houses and singing moral lessons to them, and they got out of control, so the church outlawed them. But there was a footnote at one of the carols in one of the old books I was reading, and the footnote said that carols celebrate Christ in the past, Christ in the present, Christ in the future. So if you read your typical carol, like "O Little Town of Bethlehem," the first lines will be, I got it here, "O Little Town of Bethlehem, still we see thee lie." The first one is from Micah 6:8. It's about Christ being born in the prophets, Micah 5:2. The second one is Christ being born of Mary, "But Christ is born of Mary." And that was the second Mass. And the last one is O little child of Bethlehem, descend on us, we pray, cast out our sin and enter in, be born in us today. We hear the Christmas angels, the great glad tidings tell, come with us, abide with us, O thou Emmanuel. And that was Christ being born in the heart. And it was just that footnote that made me look up things about Dickens' faith. There's a lot written on him because he had wrote letters to a friend of his by the name of Foster. And I started to read his biographies. I researched it in seminary. Then when I got this call, I had a little extra time. And so I wrote the book. And I was lucky that within 2 years it was published by Cambridge Scholars Publishers. And the first, I was saddened because they were academic books, so it was very expensive, the hard copy, but when it sold enough, they allowed me to publish a paperback, which is $35, still a little pricey, but a good Christmas present, and last Christmas, the paperback came out.
Excellent. Now, Pastor Cheryl, where can people listening purchase your book?
Amazon.com is the place that's most inexpensive.
Okay.
You can, if you try to go to the bookstore, because it's in England, at Cambridge Scholars Publishers, it's pounds and dollars, so it's not as easily done. But also Barnes & Noble has it as well. Barnes & Noble, you can click in there, and they have it on their website. So you can order it through the website, and the local store may pick it up for you.
Okay, great. And as far as promoting your book, do you get out into the community and talk to different groups about it? Are you ever, on a circuit, or how do you do that?
I try to. It's a little difficult because Christmas is the most busy time at my job.
Right.
It's also the time to promote the book. But right. I do try to take speaking engagements right before Thanksgiving and local speaking engagements when I get them. And, so I've appeared on a few talk shows, and basically internet shows, it's getting out there, but it's always slow to promote a book. It's not the easiest thing to do, and authors told me that for the longest thing. They said first there's the writing, and that seems hard, and the publishing seems harder, like it's never going to get published, but promoting is just as hard as the publishing, and it's very accurate. Once you publish a book, you're not sure free to make a fortune. Unless you write something like the purposeful Harry Potter, you're not going to make $1 million. Most of us don't. We make just a couple of bucks. So, but that's not why we write, and that needs to be remembered. And also, you want a book that's going to stay in print for a long time. So sometimes books that are shooting stars that make a lot of money right away will go out of print right away. So something that builds up slowly is not a bad thing. So getting a decent website, which I'm glad that I have one, and getting a decent publicist to get you jobs, and you do a lot of calling. You do a lot of work on your own as well. I had cards printed up, so whenever I speak, I can give them out, and people can know how to contact me.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one thing I think, no matter whether I'm interviewing an author who's been traditionally published or if they've self-published, they all say the same thing, that they still do, the same amount of work in terms of, marketing it and getting the message out there. And I found in my experience, too, people are as interested in you as the author as they are in the book itself.
Yeah.
So it's important to be able to communicate, and you express yourself so eloquently. And, of course, obviously being a pastor, that's part of your profession as well. But you have such a great way of explaining things.
Oh, thank you.
And you're welcome. And Pastor Cheryl, now your website is at dickensandchristianity.com, correct?
That's
anybody,
right, yes.
Okay. So please, everyone listening, go to dickensandchristianity.com to find out more about Pastor Cheryl and her book. It's called Hearing the Gospel Through Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. I think that your book is so, it's really for everybody. I know it's obviously a way of explaining Dickens and Christianity. But I think no matter, first of all, no matter what denomination of Christian you are, I think it's an important read for everybody to truly understand the messages he was trying to convey. But I think also really no matter what your faith is, I just think there are a lot of important lessons there that we can translate into real life if we choose to.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important since we all are part of the of the Christmas celebration in one way or another. It's important for us to understand how Christmas came about and how the church struggled with it and still does. And you can understand some of the struggles that we still have today with it, the secular and the
right.
sacred.
Absolutely. Like, you know, well, and another holiday that I can think of too, well, not that this really is, not that any the church is trying to condense it into a church holiday, but for example, Halloween, I know there are a lot of people who point out the fact that, you know, that started out as a pagan ritual holiday, whatever you want to call it, as well. And,
but
you know,
the Puritans took it and they said, we're going to pray that night. It'll be a Hallowed
yeah.
Eve. We will hallow it with our prayers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so... And actually the mockery of the spirits kind of, and people don't realize this, and I understand why a lot of Christians don't want to celebrate it. I get it. But the children dressing up in costume didn't come from the pagan world. That came from the Christian world trying to say, this is nothing to be frightened of. Let's make fun of them.
Wow.
Our God's more powerful than that. So that's another celebration I think that is largely misunderstood. For parents who are scared to let their kids go trick-or-treating, you can tell them that. It's not that I'm celebrating demons and ghosts. I'm saying they're nothing to be frightened of. I believe in, greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world.
Wow, I just got a chill. Thank you for bringing that up because, you know, I've always, you know, I grew up celebrating Halloween in my family, and we were Catholic, and we prayed, and we believed in God and Jesus. And I just thought of it as something fun, you know, to go out and get dressed up as something, and you just have some fun with your friends kind of a thing. And although we knew it was pagan in origin. So thank you for bringing that out. I did not know that about how the Puritans kind of took it and said, okay, we're gonna change the meaning of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Really fascinating. Excellent. Well, in the last couple of minutes, Pastor Cheryl, is there anything else you'd like to let our audience know before we sign off for the day?
I have another book. I'm sorry. It's called The
okay.
Little Candle That Was Frightened of the Dark. And that's also on Amazon.com, and that is a celebration of the Advent wreath as well, and it's one little candle that's inside the church. It's a baptismal, it's a war memorial candle, and the candles of the Advent wreath are sitting around a wreath, and he says that he's scared of the dark, and each of the candles tell him the Christmas story, trying to bring him out of his fear. And finally, the little candle learns that if he looks up at the Christ candle, his wick will naturally extend, and he'll give out a greater light to combat the dark. And it's taken from the passage, in him was light, and that light was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never overcome it. And so that book is available as well at Amazon.com.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'm going to have to get that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's on Kindle as well.
Great. Okay, good. Well, Pastor Cheryl, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. And I encourage everyone to please get your books. You can get them at Amazon.com. Visit DickensandChristianity.com to find out more about Pastor Cheryl. And again, thank you for taking the time and joining me on WriteStream today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was the wonderful Pastor Cheryl. I really enjoyed that interview, learned so many things that I didn't know, and I hope that if you weren't able to listen live, I hope that people listening into the archives will enjoy it as well. And I think we had two fabulous guests today. Both were very inspiring in their own right. So again, please check out Boon Yam, Tomorrow I'm Dead, about his experience as a slave and then an eventual escapee. And a leader of the Cambodian Freedom Army. It will give you a renewed sense of appreciation for your freedoms. And also please check out DickensandChristianity.com, Reverend Cheryl Kincaid and her book, Hearing the Gospel Through Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. And also check out all of her work. As she said, it's all available on Amazon.com. So that's going to wrap up WriteStream for Tuesday, April 16th, 2013. I want to thank you for joining me. We will have the WriteStream Twitter chat this coming Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Hope you'll join in for that. not quite sure what we're going to be discussing yet. I don't have a guest, but, you know, I'm thinking I'm just going to put a topic out there, and we'll just all kick it around as authors and writers and see if we can help each other out. Of course, next week I'll be back here at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition of WriteStream Tuesday. And the next Blog Talk Radio show coming up will be Just Believe with host Lisa Tarvez, and that will air this coming Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So everyone, rejoice, keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity, and we'll see you back here for another edition of WriteStream.